Mr. Sykes, Reel 11. Is there anything else or any stories you can tell us from that a year and a bit that you spent at Kleintal? That
well, I think one of the things that really needs mentioning is one of the chaps that was there, a bloke named Tom Tate, who came from Northumberland, on the Christmas Eve of all times, just before we were actually breaking up for Christmas, Tom got killed. What we were doing is shooting the logs down the mountainside. We used to shoot the logs down the mountainside on the snow and on other logs. And where they accumulated at the bottom, we could put them in stacks.
And you'd do that as well?
And we were doing that. And because in some cases it had to turn a corner, you'd have somebody posted, we'd have a fire going, somebody would be posted on the track, as it were. And if there was a log jam, it was their job to go on and loosen the jam off before it, you know, to allow it to go down the hill. And Tom was at one of these stations, and the procedure was that you shouted up to the people at the top some signal, like, I think it was Watty Hay or something like that, and that was the signal to stop sending the logs down, and they cleared the jam, and then Watty Ho, and you were off again releasing the logs. And we think what must have happened is Tom must have either forgot to shout or we didn't hear him or something happened. He tried to clear it quickly without, without shouting. And the log must have hit him and killed him. And when we were coming down the track, we found him lying at the side of the track, dead. And this was on the, as I say, on the Christmas Eve. All time just before we broke up.
How did the logs roll over, or did they?
They slide.
They slid end on.
Well, what you do, you build up. It slides on the ice mostly, but you build up a bit of a sort of a trough with logs down the hillside. Are you with me? Like that, you know. Say about three or four on the top, and wedged a couple up at the side. So they're sort of, it's a bit like a track going down. And of course, you couldn't turn them straight down, you had to turn at times. And where they turned, you had somebody actually on there to release them. You had a sarbin, what they had a sarbin, it was like a pole with a spike on it, where you levered these logs and sent them on.
Sent them on the next bit.
On to the next bit. And Tom was on them. And, so that was a bit of a thing. They took him down to Eaglebark on a sledge, and the Germans arranged to have a grave dug in the church there. And on Boxing Day, we went down to bury him, you know, as I was in charge, because I was a senior engineer. When we got there, they'd done nothing with him, unfortunately. He was still there with dried blood all over him and in a hell of a state, so they refused to bury him like that. So they got his stuff and we cleaned him up. Sent back for some clean shirts and that. Sort of redressed him, and then by then it was night time, and we buried him virtually in the dark, as it were. We did the best we could, like, we didn't know what to say, but we said the big, like, passages and sort of did the Lord's Prayer and the best you could, you know. And the only thing was the priest of the church came out with his, this incense thing, and sort of he gave the blessing over the grave, and that was it, unfortunately. You know, and that was the end of Tom, as it were. And after the war, I actually went and visited his parents to tell him what had happened. You know. And a couple of years down, place in Northumberland. But that, I think that's worth recording. You know, it was just one of the unfortunate things.
Any other stories of any sort that you remember of your time there?
there was an amusing time once. We managed to scrounge a barrel of beer, or we traded it or something. We got a small barrel of beer, and some bright spark said that it would be more potent if we put some raisins in it, which was which we got from the Red Cross Party. And to cut a long story short, the damn thing exploded. We lost a lot. Through the end of it, it fermented. So that was the reason. But, you know, the other thing that we had, I don't think I mentioned this, we managed to get some instruments from the Red Cross. And we had a violin.
You mentioned the instruments, yeah.
I did.
Did you actually form a little band?
We formed a little band. I played the violin, and as soon as I was in, I wanted to read music, so I used to sort of get the tunes up from the music, and these would follow, and we had the violin, as I remember, the mandolin, a couple of guitars, and the banjo, and a bloke named Gus Hall, who was a Welshman, he played the banjo, and the Maoris played the others, and I played the violin, and we used to entertain the troops. Right, that was quite interesting.
You said that one time one of the lads took one of the guards and got him drunk, or?
Well, no, they found him drunk.
He
was coming back. He'd been out and he'd got drunk on snaps or something, and he brought him back.
I was wondering how he came to be in a pub.
There was a sort of halfway down from the larvae down to Eagle Back. There was a sort of an inn. I don't know, did they tell you about the time when we killed the pigs for them? No. We'd got a whiff, I think when we were in the main prison camp, that if you were a farmer or a butcher or something like that, you got cushy jobs. Well, whether it was true or not, it was just one of those stories. But I had worked for a butcher before the war, and I'd put myself down as a butcher, and they called it a fly shower. And anyway, they knew about this, and one of these Maori lads, he'd been a butcher. Well, they were supposed to declare all their animals, you know, to the state and everything, and not keep on with the land. But what they did, they used to keep the odd animal and knock it off the shelves, you see, and kill it. So they said, oh, well, the meekle, they used to call me the meekle, I think I mentioned that before. There was a bloke in the village, a cobbler, who used to eat the cats. I told you, I think you all didn't. There was a cobbler in the cobbler, and he used to eat cats. And the rector was a bit mad. And his name was Meekle. And they used to let Mallory be a bit mad. I don't know. You know, yeah. And they called me the Meekle. Anyway, you know. And I've lost it to him with all the same.
About the pigs.
Oh, yes. And they said, oh, well, the Meekle is the fly shower, so he can kill the pigs for us. And we did. While we were there, we killed about 1, 2, 3 pigs for them. And of course, what we did was with an axe, back of an axe, stunned them to knock them out, slit their throats, pull them up, and kill the pigs for them, me and this Maori lad. And of course, our reward was we used to get the liver or something like that from them. And that was to keep us quiet, you know, because they weren't supposed to do it. We did. I did one for the fierce, one for the woman at the at the inn and one for the one of the blokes.
Did you get paid at all? I mean, you know.
We used to get some kind of money, and it was in the form of, I can't remember what it was in the form. I think we used to get, yeah, I think it was marks. It was paper money. And with that, we used to get so much. And I think that was for working for them. It wasn't a lot. But that's what we put together, come together to buy the beer, as I was doing now. And, you know, could get bits and bobs from the zinc. I can't think what we called it. I can't remember it. But, you know, we got bits from that. And that's, yes, we did get a little bit of money. And that's what we kind of say, you know, you buy the snaps and that sort of thing. But that was about it.
So, that really covers your time there at Clientele. How did you come to leave? I think you escaped in around about February 1945. Right. Could you tell me the background to what made you decide to do that?
Well, we heard on the grapevine that the Russians were coming. Why the Russians were anything, I don't know, but they were supposed to be coming. And we got it into our heads that we ought to be doing something about it. And the idea was that if we escaped, we could perhaps go up and meet them, you know. It might sound a bit far-fetched now, but that, at the time, was what we thought we would do. So what we did, we saved up a fair amount of our Red Cross stuff. And the day we decided to escape, somebody attracted the guards' attention, and somebody else nipped off up into the hills and hid these haversacks and rucksacks and things that we'd got with all our stuff in it, you see. Came back for a while, probably, and then at night we lifted the plank. I told you it was a building, and the upstairs where the loo, well, where the tin was for the loo and everything, that was, beneath that was empty. Well, we lifted the floorboards up and dropped through there and went up into the hills. And there was.
How many of you?
About five of us, I think. I can't remember, there was five or six. I asked my brother-in-law today, and he said he's. I can't remember, it was five or six. I think there was five of us.
And which five went? All English or a mix?
They're all English. One was a South African. Jack Downey was South African. I think Andy Fulford was a New Zealander. And then there was me and Ted, my brother-in-law, and somebody else I'll call it.
And why hadn't the others come? Had you told them what you were doing? Or?
Oh, yeah, well, they all knew, but...
why hadn't they wanted to come?
I don't know. I think the Maoris wanted to do their own thing, you know what I mean? And the others were down below as well, you know, and so it made it a bit awkward for them to get out, I think, as well. But anyway, we got down through there and went up into the hills and collected our gear. The idea being, as I say, our intention was to try and meet up with any oncoming troops, as it were.
So what gear had you got in the haversacks? What exactly did you have?
Well, we had our underwear and spare boots and mostly tins of stuff from our Red Cross parties and tea and coffee and that sort of stuff. All that we could scram, biscuits, clean milk and all that.
Were you in charge? As
I was, because, I mean, I'd been in charge all the while because I was the senior NCO, because I was a full sergeant. Well, all the officers, of course, had gone to off lads and everything, and the most senior in any of the camps we were in, of course, were warrant officers. And of course, when we broke up into groups, I was in charge of that group because I was still in charge.
So what did you plan to do, being in charge? So
well, what we intended to do, as I say, was to go out and try and find our way through the hills as best we could, and make our way towards Gratz and everything, where we'd heard that these so-called troops were coming, and try and meet up with them. The very first night we were out, I was leading the troops through the dark, and I was making for a deer feeder that I knew up in the hills. The idea being got there and kicking down, and then they had these places where they used to put hay in to feed the deer. And I was making for one of these, and I was walking down this path in the dead of night, and of all things, bumped into somebody. And I don't know who was the most surprised, him or me. Another of the lads dived into the side of the road, and I was left there with the bloke. It was the Fiercener. The Fiercener, I'm not quite sure what that means in German, but he was the, what you might call the head forester, the bloke in charge of all the, you know, all the foresters and the woodcutting and all that kind of thing. He was an honest bloke. And of course I knew him, and he said,
what did it mean?
I said, oh, it's like I said, good Lord, you know, who is he? And he said, who is it in German? And I said, oh, it's the Minkle, you know. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, we're escaping. It is special truth, I know it sounds funny, but I said, oh. He says, who is with you, you see? So I said, oh, the Whitaker and the Island and so on. And he said, do you really want to escape? So he said, yes. So he let us go. And he was up there on his own, what he was hoping to achieve, sort of patrolling the forest at night on his own.
He wasn't actually looking for you then?
No, nobody knew we were going or anything. It was just that...
That was on the first night that you met him?
That was the first night out, yeah. And anyway, he let us go and we made our way up to this...
Could he have stopped you? I mean...
He's got a gun. And I suppose he could have stopped us if he'd have wanted to. Well, he could have certainly stopped me. Because I was the one... Basically, the others might have run off in the valley. But he said, oh, we're out, that's what we want, and let him go. So we went up, as I said, to this deer feeder and kept up there. And then what we were trying to do was keep out of the way and make our way. Well, I mean, what you don't realise, of course, these Alps are big hills to climb, and you know, until you get out, you don't really know where you're going or what direction. You've got no compasses, no room, sort of doing it by guess and by God, sort of thing. You know, we didn't see many people, and altogether, I think we were out for about 5 days trying to find our way around and trying to find these, you know, looking out.
Were you able to find any food, or were you just on what you carried?
On what we got.
You said you didn't see many people. What other people did you see beside that?
We saw some escaped prisoners once, not our own. I think they were, I've no idea they were Polish, because eventually we met up with them again in the camp. I think they were sort of Polish. We saw one or two Germans in uniform, and we think they were escaped when we hid behind trees and everything. We saw them.
Did they see you?
Well, if they did, they didn't do anything about it, and that's why we felt that they were escaping Germans, you know what I mean? running away.
Deserters?
Deserters, that's the American word. And later on, I think that proved to be right, because I'll tell you about that later on.
So you were out about 5 days.
We were out about 5 days.
What state were you in after that? Because it's quite a long time to be out in the open. In the
open. Well, we slept under the trees. And we hadn't had shaves or anything. You know, we don't know where to shave.
Did you not get cold because it was February?
Well, yeah, it was cold at night times, but we had our overcoat trees and that. You know, we got to the castle. I'm not sure whether we had a blanket or not. I can't remember that exactly. But, yes, it was very cold. We did our best. And then this particular day, we were walking down this path, me leading the air wars. I think by then, two of the blokes, I think, had left us by then. They decided to clear off on their own. And
why was that?
Well, you know, we all had our own ideas about what we should be doing, one thing or another. And whether they got fed up and decided to do it, they went off.
Which two, do you remember?
One of them was Jack Diamond, I can't remember the other
one. He was the one you couldn't remember before?
The one I couldn't remember before, I think. And then they went off. And we turned this corner, and lo and behold, there's about half a dozen of the Home Guard. Whether they were out looking for prisoners, I think, or out looking for deserters or something, up in the hills, and of course we walked straight into them.
Austrian Home Guard.
Austrian. And of course, they were all with me, and they were, again, the old hoopla business. An expression of surprise or something, really. And of course, they'd all got rifles and everything. And that was the end of our escape business.
How did they treat you when they recaptured you?
Oh, they were quite all right. They took us down to Ebelback.
About how far had you got? Because if you're still near Ebelback.
It appears that we'd more or less gone round in circles, you know what I mean? We hadn't got all that far. I think when they picked us up, we must have been about 10 miles away. Like that.
So, yes, that's not far.
It's not far.
And had you marched by day, by night or by day? Or
mostly by day, because at night we were sort of holding up on the trees or on the deer feeders or whatever, you know.
How did you feel about being recaptured? I mean, were you quite pleased, really? Or
no, it was. We felt. I think it. I wouldn't say it was a relief, but it was just the fact that we hadn't got anywhere. That was the problem. I mean, we didn't know. We didn't really know where we were going, and there was no sounds of gunfire or anything going off or any planes overhead bombing or doing to give us any idea where anything might be really happening, you know what I mean? And that, and as I say, if you can imagine these huge hills and everything, and you walk up one and then you want to look around and see where you are and think, you know, and you go down somewhere else and it's surprising. And I think that was one of the reasons that the Germans weren't too fussy about you being fairly free, because, in a sense, there weren't many places you'd go to.
So you were taken down into Ebelbach?
And put in the little prison cell there, and they put us in there, and one of the local ladies brought us some food in while we were there. And and one of the blokes, and again I can't remember his name, and I asked Ted if he could remember who came, he put his name on the cell. He'd written it up. So he'd been picked up before us. So he either had given himself up or he'd been picked up. One of them had been with us. And he'd been there before us.
And how long were you kept there for?
About a day, that was one. And from there, they took us from there, and they took it to, I think it was an internment camp, and it was a place called Pongau. Pongau on the Draw, D-R-A-U, that I think. And that was the name of the actual Pongau. And this was, in fact, a sort of an internment camp where they'd got all these, what you might call, political prisoners there. And they'd rounded up us and a few Frenchmen, and one or two of these Poles or something there, and they'd rounded them all up and they took us there, I suppose, because they didn't know where else to take us. And we were in that place for about 5 or 6 days, I should imagine. And each day they took us out and had us digging trenches. And it's supposed to be for the defence of whatever they were trying to defend. And all these little prisoners from the four of us took us out with these guns and made us dig trenches. That was what we were doing. After we'd been there about 5 days or so, they decided that all the what you might call non-political prisoners, all these like us, for instance, they'd been rounding up all the prisoners of war and were accumulating them up there. Well, we've discovered this afterwards. They've been rounding them all up. And we're accumulating all prisoners of war somewhere up near Salzburg. And so what happened was they decided to set us off. And we had to march, or walk, or whatever you want to call it, to our destination. In other words, we didn't take it on buses or trains or lorries or anything. It was a walking journey. And we walked for something like 2 weeks, right across from Ponga, up near to Salzburg.
How many were on this march?
Well, for a start, from the internment camp, there'd be about a dozen or so, I would think. But eventually, we caught up with the main body of prisoners of war, and then there must have been a couple of hundred others, I think.
And how many guards?
20. The guards always blast off a rumour, I think. You know what I mean? They'd wander along with us, and we more or less got the impression that things were coming to an end, you know what I mean? And I think the guards thought so too.
Were they Austrian or German?
Austrian. And they were taking us to, to this place where all the prisoners were going to be accumulated.
What was the routine like on the march? I mean,
well, what we did, we just marched off from place to place. And when we got there at night time, they provided us with a bit of soup and a bit of bread. But during the day, we used to send scouts out ahead. They'd go out and catch us up at night. And they'd go out trading for food and, for food mostly, for apples, bread, potatoes, anything. And we'd swap tea out of our...
Who'd send these scouts out, the guards or would you
not? We, you know, they were our own blood. The guards wouldn't take a blind bit of notice. and they just let them go off because, I mean, and we'd change cigarettes, coffee, underwear, if we'd got a bit of spare, anything, you know, that, with the local communities.
They were willing to trade, were they? Didn't you soon run out? Because you wouldn't be getting Red Cross parcels on the march.
We'd take them as what we could. As I say, I mean, all we'd got really was what we had left from our escaping thing. Because obviously when we were in the internment camp, we didn't get anything, any Red Cross parcels there or anything like that.